Okay, everyone. Now we'll begin with the formal teaching about how to meditate. First, in this time before we take our tea break, something after 11, I will give you the philosophical basis of what meditation is and a little bit of an understanding of what Kriya Yoga is, and then the first steps toward Kriya Yoga. You actually started in Kriya Yoga when you said, I'm awake and ready, I'm positive, energetic, enthusiastic. It may not have fit your idea of what Kriya Yoga is, but it really is a first step. Everything you're going to be learning from now, from when you came in until the end, is all the foundations. Just like by the time somebody goes to a big American university and gets a doctorate degree, every single thing that he learned up to that point is part of it. So Kriya is a specific initiation that you may qualify for over, it takes between 6 months and a year, but you qualify for it and you're able to do it because of everything that you learn right from the beginning. It's like, there's really like four legs to a table, of which the Kriya proper initiation is one. The word meditation is used a lot, and people have ideas in their mind of what meditation is. But sometimes it helps if we become very clear in very specific ways about exactly what we're doing. Very often confusion or lack of success is really because we are confused on a very basic level. So let's start on a very basic level with what it is that we're doing when we meditate. All of the scriptures tell us, even our own intuition tells us, that this world, there's more going on in this world than is obvious. I remember being a little girl, and I had this feeling from a very young age. Now I think of it as samskaras from having been a yogi in past lives, previous incarnations being a disciple of this path, but growing up in El Paso, Texas, in the United States of America, none of those thoughts were being talked about. But I just had a feeling that there was something much deeper and more important going on. And as a little child, I decided that my parents and my teachers knew what that was, and they were just waiting for me to get a little older, and then they would tell me. And as I got older, the opposite happened. I began to realize that they really basically had no idea either. That they really didn't have any deeper understanding than I did. They were just bigger and had been living this life longer. That was when I became, I think desperate is actually the word. I became very, very concerned about how I was going to live in this world. And just to finish my personal story a little bit, I was always very good at school. It was just something I was born knowing how to do. It never took any effort from me, and therefore it didn't mean anything to me. But I got all the way and was accepted at Stanford University, which was a big deal. And I decided that at such a great university, they would surely know. But within 2 weeks, it was quite clear to me that they were intelligent, they were knowledgeable, but they were not wise. And I wanted somebody to talk to me about the meaning of life and about the most obvious thing in the world to me, which was how to be happy. And it just wasn't enough to say, well, get this job, get married, have these children, get this money. Nobody was ever talking about the whole reason underneath it, which was that somehow it would give me something inside and not merely all of this. So to make a short story even shorter, I flunked out of Stanford. I made top grades and bottom grades, just depending. And then the net result was I had to drop out because I was so not interested. But Stanford gave me Swami Kriyananda by the end because he was invited to speak there. And when I saw him, it was interesting, and I said this at the music hall, most of you were there. He walked into the room. He did not speak. I didn't know if he was educated, uneducated. I never met him in my life. But he carried in his aura, well, now I would call it bliss. He carried the only thing that I had ever wanted, was this sort of, how could I call it? He had his place in the world, and he was standing in much more reality than anyone I had ever met. And as soon as I saw it, I just said, that's it. That's exactly what I'm looking for. Swami told the story about the man trying to get out of the army, rejecting every piece of paper until he got his discharge notice. Well, Swami Kriyananda walked in, and I said, that's it. For many years now, then, I have followed him and studied with him and understood what it is that he has. And the great glory of this, you see, is that it's something that belongs to all of us. What the great message of Yogananda for this age is about, and for those of you who wish to stay until later in the afternoon, we're going to do a whole other session just talking about Yogananda's mission. But what he brought, and this was a uniquely American message, which is how, you know, we thought he belonged to us until we got bigger and recognized he belongs to the world. But he brought this message. America's, you know, without caste, without class. You can come to America from any background, and if you work hard, you can rise to the highest position. You know, the President of the United States today did not start in a privileged way. He's of a minority race. His background was meager. But America is like that. So Yogananda planted a divine truth, and he was able to plant it in America. Self-realization belongs to everyone, and all we have to do is take the proper steps, and we can have it completely. And he called those steps Kriya Yoga. So what we're doing when we're meditating, we're not accomplishing anything. We're not studying lessons. We're not passing exams. We are simply realizing, and realizing is the key word. When you realize something, it was always there, but you didn't notice. You know, I realize that I am the daughter of a king, and I have a position in the world that I didn't know I had. I can't create that. I just have to realize it. Of course, that's a fantasy. But what we're living in, we think that we are defined by these bodies that we live in. We think that we are limited by the senses that we use to perceive this world. We think that we're limited by our age and our culture and all these things. We don't realize who we really are. Meditation is the doorway through which we can realize who we really are. The greatest realization is self-realization, self meaning the divine within. These are principles that have been part of your culture forever, but the doorway to it has been obscured over time. So the principle of meditation is based on the idea that there are fundamentally, and this is a simplification, but there are basically three levels of consciousness that we are working with all the time. We talk about the subconscious, we talk about the conscious, and we talk about the superconscious. Okay? In Western psychology, subconscious has a big meaning, but let's forget what Western psychology says and let's think of it more as we understand it in the tradition of Sanatan Dharma. The subconscious is everything that's happened before now. And in the West, where they don't believe in previous incarnations, they try to explain everything from what happens to you from the time you come out of your mother's womb. In fact, they make a whole psychological system of getting out of the mother's womb as the cause of a great many things that happen. Truly, it's a little silly, but that's just what they have to do because that's where they start. In here, we can speak more easily about previous incarnations. Everything that's happened to us before has created certain impressions deep within our consciousness that caused us to be born in a certain place, under certain conditions, with certain attitudes. We're oriented in a certain way. Speaking just in one life, if you have a positive upbringing, you have a positive orientation toward life. If you have a privileged upbringing, if you have an abusive upbringing, you're oriented in a certain way. You can imagine that's a lot of stuff. Not only what we can find out in this lifetime, but all those things that happened in previous lifetimes. I was sharing in an informal gathering in my living room back in my home in Palo Alto. It's not my home, it's where I live. I don't have a home anymore, but it's where I live. And I was just sharing with people this experience that I had. My husband's name is David. We are in this work together. We're both Naya Swamis, and we run our temple together. You will often hear me speak of him. He and I have traveled a great deal through the world, and there was a period of time in my life when I became very nervous in the airport if he would walk away from me. If I was at the gate waiting for the plane to come, I would love a bottle of water. Is that possible? Or a glass of water or something. I would become very nervous about him leaving me. Now, he's an intelligent man. He's not going to miss the plane. But I would become unreasonably anxious. At first, he disregarded me, and then he saw that I was serious, that I really was afraid. I was just telling the story, and I gradually got over it just with common sense. I'm telling the story, and this woman says to me afterwards that she had a vision of me as a little girl being the daughter of a widowed father, and the father couldn't take care of me, so he took me on the train to another town and just left me there. And that, oh, my panic in the airport was because of being abandoned as an 8-year-old child in a railroad station. To my dismay, I felt it. I felt the fear of being in the railroad station. I mean, I felt all of it. Interestingly, I had two thoughts simultaneously. One, that it was a very difficult lifetime, and two, that it was a very important lifetime, that I learned many things I needed to know from that. But I thought to myself, subconscious mind has to be respected. You know, just think of all these things that are coming up. Okay, that's one side of it. Now I'm going to go to the other side, which is superconscious. What we have to understand about subconscious also is that it can rearrange the past for us. When we sleep, we have interesting dreams sometimes. But the only thing that the subconscious can give us is what it already knows. It can't create anything completely new. It can just rearrange the information. And sometimes that's instructive, like my friend telling me that she had this thought of what my life experience, whether it was true or not, it actually taught me something. But the subconscious is not in itself creative. It doesn't take us any place that we haven't already been. That's the job of the superconscious. The superconscious is the side of us that expands out to infinity. And this is where we're going. This is not where we've been, but where we're going. And where we're going is upward to infinity. And it is through the superconscious dimension of ourselves that we unite with infinity. And it is from the superconscious that true inspiration comes. True artistic excellence, true intuition. This woman, Priya, told us earlier that she was stopped on the street by someone who felt they had a divine message for her, and that's brought her here, so let's assume that it was a true message. And if that woman who spoke to her was truly inspired, then information was given to her from her connection with the infinite that she didn't already have. And so then she offered it out like this. I'm sure all of you have had experiences where you just know something and you have no reason to know it, but you just know it. And when you learn after a while, when you know in that certain way, there is no possibility of it not coming true. It's just, I was involved once in this terribly complicated and controversial project. I was initiating something that nobody else wanted me to do. And I was talking to Swami Kriyananda, and I said, but sir, it came to me in that particular way. And he said, oh yes, then of course do it. You know, just like yes. Because when it's truly superconscious, now it's tricky, just to be fair, because subconscious can sometimes masquerade. Subconscious can often sometimes speak really powerfully to you because it's the accumulation of everything you're familiar with. So that's a whole nother conversation that we'll have some other time, how to tell the difference. But everything that is expansive for us, that's going to take us where we're trying to go, not merely in this incarnation, but in all our incarnations, is that draw into superconsciousness. Now, the conscious mind, which we're used to, let me say one more thing about this. One of the characteristics of subconsciousness is that it's completely individual. It's most strongly manifested by sleep. If you're asleep, you can be lying right in the same room with someone else, and you can make up fantastic experiences. You can travel to foreign countries, you can see great souls, you can see your relatives who are dead or whatever it might be, but you're the only one who knows it. You wake up and you speak to this person sleeping in the room with you and they don't have any experience of it. Now, even when we're awake, sometimes we're living a little more. We're living a little more in subconsciousness, which is the world that we live in is still a world of our own making. And that's what happens when people will say to you, "You're angry, I know you're angry at me." And you say, "I'm not angry at you." "Yes, you are, yes, you are." You know, "You looked at me in a certain way." "I didn't." "Yes, you did, yes, you did." That's subconscious when the world that you think is there is just your world. There's no connection. Now, the conscious mind, when you're in consciousness, as we are all here more or less at the moment, there's a greater shared reality. You know, if we all walked out of this room and you were asked, you would know approximately where you were sitting. You would know there was an American woman. Those of you who notice would notice I'm dressed in blue. Those of you who are more observant would know that I have curly hair. You know, some of the people you would say she had curly hair, and others would say, "Did she?" You know, because we notice certain things, we don't notice others. If you compared notes even on what I've said, you would all remember different things. But still, it's much more than the subconscious. We share a reality. But we can't quite unify our consciousness on this level, can we? That's why people hug each other really tight, because they're trying hard to unify consciousness when you can't quite on the level of the conscious mind. When we move out of the conscious into the superconscious, that's where all realities begin to merge. If you think of it like the fingers of a hand, when we live at the tips, we all appear to be different, both from each other and from everything around us. But if we go deeper into the reality, we discover that the origin point of all of these seeming differences is the same. So this is the superconscious. This is the source of where we all come from. Even though we tend to identify more with the separation, we don't realize what the truth of it is, you see? Merely because we don't know it doesn't make it untrue. Now, in our normal life, the conscious level is not really a thing unto itself, because we are never uninfluenced. Something is always influencing us. The way Yogananda puts it in Autobiography of a Yogi, he says, thoughts are not individual, they're universal. And we merely pick up levels of consciousness that are there to be attuned to. Okay? So we live in the conscious level, and all of our subconscious impulses are pushing on us. Let us say it was true, memory of having been abandoned in the railroad station suddenly makes me frightened when my absolutely reliable husband walks away from me in the airport. It's completely not really happening, but because of my subconscious influence, I think it is. So now, and the way I solved it, was I went, here's the superconscious influence. The superconscious influence is wise, secure, creative, attuned to the divine, surrendered to truth as it is. The superconscious mind knows that all the stories have a happy ending. That's how I put it. That all the stories have a happy ending. That's what superconscious knows. In the end, no matter how tortured the course of the river goes into the ocean in the end. And no matter how tortured the course of the river, it was always heading for the ocean. That's what superconscious knows. Because conscious mind is the battleground between the subconscious influence and the superconscious pull. We're being pulled upward towards superconscious. We're being pulled downward into all of our old habits. And it is literally, the conscious mind is the battlefield of Kurukshetra. The whole Mahabharata, the whole Bhagavad Gita takes place on that battlefield, and that's the conscious mind, Krishna pulling on this side, the darker, the more contractive forces. And this is the way to think of it, in the best way. To go where we've already been is to be contracted. To say, this is as big as I'm going to get. I'm never going to get any bigger. I was speaking. I don't want to single out the same woman over and over again, but we had a good conversation, so I won't say her name this time. that which is unfamiliar sometimes appears frightening to us. So we cling to what we already know. By the very definition, that's contractive, isn't it? I already know this. This is what I am. This is all I'm going to accomplish. This is who I want to be. Superconscious says, you're infinite. You have nothing to fear. So expansive versus contractive. The conscious mind is the battlefield. Now, that conversation can and will go in lots of directions. It relates to relationships, to financial prosperity, to getting along with other people, to success in your work, to art. But now let's talk about it in terms of meditation. What meditation teaches us is how to break the bond of the subconscious force and open the doorway to the superconscious force. And the keys to doing that, fortunately, are right within us. And that's the essence of Kriya Yoga. What makes Kriya Yoga so powerful is simple reasons that I won't go into detail, but I'll just refer to. You know, all of you know the energy that flows up and down the spine, the kundalini energy, the chakras where the vrittis of the whirlpools of past commitments and experiences, the whole subconscious reality is really a description of the chakras in the spine, the vrittis that are holding our energy, and they have a vritti as a moving force and it magnetizes our consciousness into it. That's why we are the way we are. That's why it's also difficult to escape, because we try to lift our consciousness in a certain way and those vrittis are just spinning along and they just grab it again, which is why you sit down to meditate, you're determined to pray, and all of a sudden you're thinking about the argument you had with your daughter in the morning, right? Or you're thinking about this desire that you have to get that new car and how much money would it take? Oh, I forgot. Om Guru, Om Guru. And then you try it again and it floats out and another one of those vrittis comes up and eats you. This is, don't worry, this is what the practice of meditation is. That's what we call practice. You just keep practicing, you keep trying, because this is the battleground that we're working with. But the reason, what Kriya Yoga in its ultimate expression really does for us is it works directly on the energy in the spine to dissolve those vrittis. Because once you dissolve those vrittis, then there is no energy pulling you away from superconsciousness, because conscious is the battleground, superconscious is free, the vrittis represent our past commitments. Dissolve the vrittis directly, and then the energy automatically, the river automatically flows to the sea, because that's where the river is determined to go. Planted within us are certain doorways into dissolving those vrittis and to enabling us to concentrate. And the foremost method, which is used by virtually every teacher of meditation that you will ever encounter, because if someone tells you that they have created something entirely new about human consciousness, I would be a little suspicious, because human consciousness has been the same since we were manifested from the divine. But sometimes, as I was saying earlier, there's ways to express it that make more sense in the moment. So what Yogananda has done with his teaching is he's taken a vast amount of tradition and refined it to just a few simple principles that are the essence of it. So the essential doorway to escape from the influence of our vrittis and to move more into the superconscious is the power of the breath. The breath is a very interesting reality within us, because it's right between a conscious force and a force that happens to us. We can influence the breath. We can do measured breathing. We can hold the breath. We can breathe faster, we can breathe slower. But you can't commit suicide by holding your breath. Because if you hold your breath with your willpower for as long as you want to, at a certain point, your brain will become oxygen deprived, you will pass out, and then you will begin to breathe again. Because it's not, I mean, except for yogis, which is something different. For the ordinary person who isn't trained yet in these things, We can influence the breath, but we can't control it. Now, yoga teaches us that the breath is also the connecting link between the source of our life and our life as we experience it. It's one of those keys that helps us to realize who we are. It was planted in there by God, and it has a certain divine physiology about it. When a baby is born, the concern everyone has is for that child to take its first breath. Because no matter how perfect the little body looks, until that child actually inhales, there's no certainty that that body will ever be animated. And interestingly, and they say if you're going to actually really chart the horoscope accurately, it's when the first breath is taken. That's the beginning of the horoscope, because that's the beginning. Paramhansaji says that the reason the baby cries with that first breath is not because the air hurts his lungs, but because he realizes that he is incarnated again. And he says, oh, here I am, a whole physical incarnation again. And so he protests at that moment. What am I doing here? How did I get back here? Because in the astral world, our vrittis draw us back. We're having a perfectly good time, and then all of a sudden, we sort of see that a Pizza Hut is opening in our old neighborhood, and we remember the delicious taste of pizza from the time that we lived in Italy. And then we see that that cute little girl who married my neighbor is incarnated over there. And then we see that this womb is open and this lovely mother that I always wanted to have. And pretty soon we find ourselves inhaling, and there we are with a new body. And then, of course, when someone dies, the last thing that happens, if you've ever sat with someone when they die, the last breath goes out. Very interesting. I sat with my father, and I've been with a few others who have passed away somewhat, you know, slowly. It wasn't a sudden passing. And in the last hours, at first, in the last hours, the person struggles to inhale like this. And then so that they'll be, if they're lying on a deathbed, they'll go like that. And then all of a sudden they struggle to exhale. If you're ever sitting there, that's the moment when they're about to go, because suddenly they'll start going, and then they'll take a very short inhalation, and then the next inhalation will be long. It's like the body's trying to escape, and then finally they'll succeed, and that last breath will come out. And in between, the breath is the key to life and the key to who we are. So the meditation technique that I'm going to teach you, which is essentially the first leg of the four-legged table of Kriya, is to become conscious of the breath. The other benefit of a breath-based meditation technique is it's no equipment and you have it with you all the time. There's no point in your life ever. You can be buried in an underground prison, and as long as you're alive, you still have your breath. It's another way of saying that the divine is always with us, but we simply don't realize it. And so the breath is, you might say, it's this thread. There's a Greek myth about a hero who had to go into a labyrinth and slay a monster in the middle of the labyrinth. And others would go in, but they got lost and they couldn't come out again. So the story is that the woman who loved him held a spool of thread, and he tied that thread around his wrist, and he went all the way in and he slayed the minotaur, the monster. But then he was able to follow that thread out again. Now that, to me, is a perfect picture of our life experience. Somehow, the Infinite Lord, who truly loves us, tossed us out here, and we've just wandered around doing all these things that seemed like such a good idea at the time, but now we'd like to find our way back. And God is holding that thread, and that thread is the breath. So what we do when we meditate, and I'll be more specific in just a moment, it is nothing more, it sounds like nothing much, but it is nothing more than simply observing the breath. Now, all of meditation can be defined by the simple phrase, increasing awareness. Increasing awareness. In fact, all of life can be defined by increasing awareness. Even from babyhood, all of education, baby doesn't know, it can't find its mouth with the spoon. When the baby first starts feeding himself, well, I guess you all don't use spoons, but he picks it up with his own hands like this, But he still can't find his mouth, can he? He goes like this, he hits his head, he puts the food in his ear, he throws the food over his head, because he doesn't even know where his mouth is. But he does it enough times, pretty soon he finds his mouth. He becomes aware of where his mouth is. He becomes aware of language. He becomes aware of reading. Well, at what point does that awareness stop? We consider ourselves grown up, but are we fully aware? So we're breathing all the time. And one of the signs of our lack of awareness is we don't even know it, do we? So the first part of observing the breath is simply an increase of awareness, because the breath is only one of many things that we're not aware of right now. If Krishna or Jesus Christ or Paramahansa Yogananda walked into this room right now, he would be aware of things that we're not aware of, that are presently in this room, but our conscious mind is too trapped by our subconscious to perceive the superconscious. So what we do when we're meditating is we are training our awareness of subtle realities. We're bringing our consciousness away from all that we're used to experiencing, because we're totally driven by our senses and our thoughts, aren't we? Just what we see, what we feel, what we taste, what the body is doing, what we want, and it just clouds us completely. We just don't know. And I'm sure all of you have had moments when, for one reason or another, all of that stops, and suddenly we're aware of something that we weren't aware of before. Love in our hearts, the presence of God, an expanded relationship. So we watch the breath, and what the breath does for us is it withdraws us from all of the sensory stimulation and puts us in attunement with the fundamental flow of who and what we really are. Because all of life reduces itself to inhalation and exhalation. And when we think of life as just these constantly moving waves, which is what we really experience, the closer we come to the center point, everything can be understood better from the origin. So we quiet our minds, we quiet our relationship to life by simply observing the breath. And in the essence of this practice, we do not influence the breath, although we'll do some exercises to influence the breath just to get us in tune with it. But in the practice itself, it is an exercise in awareness. Now, that's a very important point to realize, because what you may be aware of is that you have a very hard time staying aware of your breath. But even that is an increase in awareness. So there's no like success or failure, because this is a practice to become aware. We may become aware of how restless our minds are. We may become aware of underlying anxieties that we have. We may become aware of pains in our body that we didn't know were there. We can become aware of suppressed feelings that we didn't know about. But what we're doing is we're quieting our consciousness, bringing it to the center, and you see the breath runs also right through the center, which is preparing us for the practice of Kriya as we get into it later. So we're centering and interiorizing and ultimately elevating our consciousness. Centering, interiorizing, elevating, all of which is increasing awareness. So we watch the breath as it flows in and out. Now, inasmuch as this is an exercise in awareness, this is not about imagination, we have to be able to actually find the breath somewhere. So sometimes you can only know you're breathing because you've got your hands on your ribs and you can feel it. Sometimes we can feel the breath, and this just as a detail, we practice this with the mouth closed, breathing through the nostrils. Sometimes we can feel the breath as it comes in through the nostrils. Ideally, we gradually become aware of the breath here, where it enters the cavity of the head, because that also brings our attention to a focus here at the spiritual eye. I mean, all of you know of this point, all of the initiations and marks, and even women in the morning, you know, put the mark here, because this draws our attention to what is really the origin point of our superconscious self. The ego, the conscious self, is located here at the medulla. The positive pole of that is the spiritual eye. Most of us live identified with our body and our egos, and our consciousness is here. That's why we feel like we're looking at the world through our eyes. It's because our consciousness is centered at the medulla. But the spiritual eye is the positive pole of the same chakra. And we bring our attention from there to here. And breath helps us to do that, because as we get more deeply aware of the breath, we become aware of it not only as a flow of physical breath, but also as an inflow of energy right at this point. So the practice is to become aware of the breath wherever you can become aware of it, gradually, if possible, bringing our awareness at least to the nostrils and ultimately to here. All practice of meditation should be done with the spine straight, because the energy flows up and down the spine. This is not so easy to accomplish for many people. Whenever I say that, everybody quietly shifts a little and tries to straighten their spine, always. Many of you are sitting comfortably on the floor, and I'll make some comments about that. There's a tendency slightly to lean forward. Sometimes it's better if you sit on a cushion, even though you would not normally do so, because it helps raise your spine up. But it keeps your spine straight. All meditation should be done with the spine as straight as possible. And we shut off all stimulation. We don't listen, we don't look, we don't taste, we just sit, okay? And we sit in a way that's comfortable, either with the hands together in your lap like this, or open in this way. It's better to meditate either closing the circuits by joining your fingers, or if your hands are separated, with your palms up. And even if you put them together, you could put them like this. Any of these postures will work. Sometimes you'll find that mudras form. You can choose to form mudras if you like. I often find that when I sit just with my hands open, that the fingers just join, because the mudras are an expression of energy and these things happen. All of these are aids, and as we progress through this day, and also if you take subsequent classes, we can talk about it. But the most important thing is to sit comfortably, because no one in the West could sit on the floor. Yogananda always taught everybody in the West to meditate on chairs. And he promised that God realization was just as attainable through chairs, so you don't have to worry about it at all. It doesn't matter. The only thing is to be comfortable, because what you want to do is forget the body. So we're sitting in some way that is comfortable, in a receptive posture or an inwardly created posture, using the hands in that way. We are observing the breath. We are simply watching it flow wherever we can actually experience it. This is not imagination. Now, all of that is very much to the good, but I suspect all of you will still have active minds, just as I have, and that you'll find that you can observe the breath and you can just have your mind be so busy doing so many other things at the same time, multitasking, no problem, right? But what's happening is we're in the conscious level, and all of those subconscious realities, everything that we've been, are still pulling us, and we can't really follow the breath where it's going to take us. So we add to this practice a mantra. And the mantra is both, because it has power itself, it has power both in the sound of the mantra and also in the meaning of the mantra, and also, quite simply, it occupies the mind. You know, there is no such thing as an empty mind, and there really shouldn't be an empty mind. Meditation with an empty mind is not really meditation. You need to be going somewhere. And it's not possible to empty your mind. What you need to do is you need to replace what's going on in your mind with something that is going to pull you more towards superconscious. Because remember the very simple principle that we started with. The conscious mind is the battleground between the contractive reality of everything we have done up until now and the desire to expand into a reality that is our true destiny. And so when we sit to meditate and we find our mind going everywhere that it usually goes, maybe in a slightly more elevated way, but still, nothing really terrible is happening, except that the battle of Kurukshetra is taking place on the field of your consciousness, and all of your past, the subconscious side, is just pulling you back into it. Oh, you're sitting and trying to meditate. You're trying to think of God. You're trying to follow the breath into its infinite potential. Let me talk to you about something else. Let me talk to you about your day. Let me talk to you about your family, about your aspirations, your fears. And let me talk to you about that great meal you're going to have when you ever finish this meditation, right? And nothing is happening except what would happen, which is I'm trying to go this way and it's trying to go that way. And so it's very important in the practice of meditation to become completely relaxed about the fact that this happens. You're just like everyone else. But controlling the mind is, I mentioned I grew up in El Paso, Texas. I went to California soon after, so I didn't live there that long, but I lived there long enough to ride horses, not with the little English saddles like you see, but with the big Western riding saddles across the desert and across the Rio Grande River. It was really quite fun. And sometimes the horse gets the bit in his teeth, that's what it's called. The way you control the horse is he has this uncomfortable thing in his mouth, and when you pull it, it causes him to respond. Every so often, a horse gets ornery enough and smart enough at the same time that he realizes that if he takes that metal bar and clamps his teeth over it, then, first of all, he has control over it, and it's not uncomfortable anymore, and you're helpless. That's the horse gets the bit in his teeth. That's exactly what it is. And the only way you can work with that is you just have to just keep working with it for a while until you finally sort of get it loose. Now, when the horse gets the bit in his teeth, and in my case as a child, it was usually to turn around and go back to the stable, you just have to start somewhere. You can't just let go. You just have to start somewhere. But your first effort to gain mastery over that horse is completely ineffectual. Nothing happens. But your ultimate success is based on the fact that you don't quit. So when you first start meditating, sometimes people are very, very fortunate, and immediately they just take to it. Most of us are not so lucky. Most of us have to realize that we have to start. But you see, your mind, our minds, are running wild right now if we don't meditate. So even if we don't meditate well, at least we're beginning to pull it into a focus. And if we just persevere, if we just don't quit, you know, slowly by slowly, results will come to us. And there's something else that's a factor, which is even when you begin to try, you have turned your attention away from the past, away from your present reality, toward your ultimate reality, and the river of grace begins to help you. You know, when you start trying to learn something new, there's this great force that comes. Especially, we've been running away from home, in a very true sense spiritually, and as soon as we turn back, our Divine Mother and our Heavenly Father begin to pull us. So we're not all on our own with this. So, added to the observation of the breath, we have a very simple mantra. The mantra is a Bij mantra. It's words, you know, compressed to their essence, and it's a familiar mantra here. Many of you have heard it. Hong Sa. Hong Sa. You can just say it out loud with me. Hong Sa. You can feel the ong sound in there. There's power in mantras. I don't have to explain that to you. And that is also a compression of the phrase that means I am the infinite. I am the infinite. I am He. I am the infinite self. There's many ways to translate it. So what we're saying is, and the tradition is, and it's a beautiful tradition, that this is the actual sound of the breath. This is the vibratory sound of the breath. Hong Sa. Now, in a funny way, when people snore, they go, right? It's the Hong snore technique, we call that one. Which occasionally, when you sit to meditate, you end up accidentally practicing the Hong snore technique, but it's not the one you want. But it's interesting to me because the sound is there. And now when we say this mantra, we don't say it with our lips. I only had you say it just so you could hear it. We say it only with our mind. And it corresponds to the inhalation and the exhalation. Hong with the inhalation, Sa with the exhalation, entirely mentally. But what it also helps us do is it helps us keep track. The breath is coming in, the breath is coming out. So that occupies our mind. Now, the challenge of meditation is to concentrate in the moment. And so instead of saying Hong and then thinking about six or seven other things at the same time, we need to fill our entire consciousness with just that one sound as the breath comes in, and then as the breath goes out, Sa. Hong, we inhale the divine power, and then we surrender more deeply into that power. Hong, Sa. And then we add to it one more element. So we're physically sitting upright. We have our hands in the proper position. We're becoming conscious of where the breath is flowing. We're occupying the mind with the sound of the mantra, which in itself transforms the vibrations of the mind. It's not incidental. It turns the vibrations of thought into itself. Then we have to add the feeling quality to it, because without feeling, it becomes extremely boring. So this is where, even though we're not really thinking about the meaning of the mantra, we want to feel the meaning of the mantra. Hung, as the breath comes, where does our life force come from? You know, we're just living this life. Do we ever think about who gave it to us? Do we ever think in gratitude of where it comes from? Do we ever pay attention to what a gift this life is? It's potential for bliss, for perfect freedom. So as we take the Hong mantra in, as we inhale, this is a great gift of life that's being given to us by the infinite. And then when we say saw, we surrender into the happiness of that. I'm sure all of us have had the pleasure of curling up on our mother's lap as a small child. There's just that coming into that comfort and then that complete relaxation when she's there for you. And this is why we speak of Heavenly Father and Divine Mother. Bring the heart into it. Hong is the great gift of life and the great divine comforter of the mother. Saw is just the complete relaxed acceptance of that. Okay. In essence, that is the practice. And because of our timings today, you all get to have a cup of tea before you try it, which is not perfect timing, but let's do this anyway. So we're going to take a 10-minute break. Just stretch your legs, get yourselves comfortable, reflect a little on what we did, and then we'll come back and we'll meditate together. Okay?